Hello and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna. I've got a bit of an update from a story I did over a year ago about the science of the hangover. If you've ever overindulged in the consumption of alcohol, it's likely that you've experienced the medical phenomenon known colloquially as the hangover. Of course, there are other terms used to describe hangovers. Here are just some I managed to find with a few minutes research online. Black dog, blue devils, bottle ache, bust head, carpenters in the forehead, crop sick, gallon distemper, hair ache, Jim jams, Katzenjammer, morning fog, wooden mouth, the zings. Given that there's such a widespread health phenomenon, it's perhaps a bit surprising that scientists still don't fully understand the causes of hangovers. They do, however, have a scientific name for them, vasalgia. It's far from clear why, after all traces of alcohol have been fully expelled from your body, you can still experience a load of awful symptoms, including headache, dizziness, fatigue, nausea, stomach problems, drowsiness, sweating, excessive thirst, and cognitive fuzziness. The simplest and most familiar explanation is that drinking alcohol causes dehydration, both because it acts as a diuretic, increasing urine production, and because people who are drinking heavily for multiple hours probably aren't drinking much water during that time period. Alcohol keeps your body from producing a hormone called vasopressin, which regulates the amount of water your kidneys can hold. But studies examining the link between dehydration and hangovers have turned up some surprising data. One, for instance, found no correlation between high levels of the hormones associated with dehydration and the severity of a hangover. It's most likely that dehydration accounts for some of the symptoms of a hangover, dizziness, lightheadedness, and thirst, but that there are other factors at work as well. Most scientists believe that a hangover is driven by alcohol interfering with your body's natural balance of chemicals in a more complex way. One hypothesis is that in order to process alcohol, your body must convert the enzyme NAD into an alternate form, NADH. With an excess buildup of NADH and insufficient quantities of NAD, the thinking goes, your cells are no longer capable of efficiently performing a number of metabolic activities, everything from absorbing glucose from the blood to regulating electrolyte levels. But this hypothesis, too, has been contradicted by data. In studies, people with severe hangovers weren't found to have lower levels of electrolytes or glucose in their blood. Currently, the most compelling theory is that hangovers result from a buildup of acetaldehyde, a toxic compound in the body. As the body processes alcohol, acetaldehyde is the very first byproduct, and it's estimated to be between 10 and 30 times as toxic as alcohol itself. In control studies, it's been found to cause symptoms such as sweating, skin flushing, nausea, and vomiting. These effects are compounded by something called glutamine rebound. As a depressant, alcohol dampens your body's production of a natural stimulant called glutamine. As soon as your drinking stops, your body tries to fix this by making a ton of the stuff. Since most folks do their serious drinking late at night, that means your brain is full of stimulants just as you're getting to sleep. This can make the grogginess of a hangover feel even worse. Hangovers could also be driven by the way alcohol messes with your immune system. Studies have found strong correlations between high levels of cytokines, molecules the immune system uses for signaling, and hangover symptoms. Normally, the body might use cytokines to trigger a fever of inflammatory response to battle an infection, but it seems that excessive alcohol consumption can also provoke cytokine release, leading to symptoms like muscle aches, fatigue, headache, or nausea, as well as cognitive effects like memory loss or irritation. Another interesting question is why do some people get hangovers more easily? Life, alas, isn't fair. Some people are extremely prone to hangovers, and some can drink with impunity. It seems that genetics are partly to blame. Some people, disproportionately those of East Asian descent, have a mutation in their gene for the enzyme alcohol dehydrogenase that makes it more effective in converting alcohol into the toxic acetaldehyde. Unfortunately, a significant part of this group also has a mutation in the gene for the enzyme that performs the next metabolic step, leading to a much slower conversion of acetaldehyde into acetic acid. As a result, excessive buildup of acetaldehyde can happen quite rapidly. This can cause an immediate alcohol flush reaction, but may also play a role in hangovers the day after drinking. We can also ask, why do some drinks cause hangovers more easily than others? Because the ultimate cause of a hangover is, after all, alcohol, drinks that pack more alcohol into a smaller volume are naturally more likely to give you a hangover. Shots of liquor, in other words, are more dangerous than mixed drinks, beer, or wine. There are other factors that affect who experiences hangovers most readily. After having the same number of drinks, women are more likely to experience hangovers than men, though this simply seems to be a result of the fact that women generally have a lower body weight as well. If you control for body weight and compare a man and a woman with the same blood alcohol content, their chances of a hangover are similar. There's conflicting evidence over whether hangovers become more frequent with age. Some studies have suggested that adolescents are less likely to experience hangovers, but a recent large-scale survey showed the opposite, that even controlling for total alcohol consumption, drinkers over the age of 40 experienced fewer and less severe symptoms. The authors noted that it's possible, though, that they consume the same amount of alcohol, but with less intensity, spreading their drinks out instead of binging. Beyond that, though, some drinks happen to have higher levels of congers, trace chemicals produced during fermentation, that contribute to hangovers. Studies have shown that high congener dark-colored liquors like bourbon and whiskey lead to more severe hangovers than lighter-colored or clear liquors like vodka. A Dutch study systematically looked at the congener content and hangover risk of a variety of types of alcohol. It ranked various drink combinations by their congener content versus the severity of the hangover produced. The drink with the least congeners, pure ethanol mixed with orange juice, produced the least severe hangover, followed in order by vodka, gin, white wine, whiskey, rum, red wine, and worst of all, brandy. One particular congener called methanol, also known as wood alcohol, found in highest levels in whiskey and red wine, has received a large amount of the blame due to studies showing that it can linger in the body after all other alcohol has been eliminated, perhaps accounting for the enduring effect of a hangover. This, incidentally, could explain the widely held belief that mixing different sorts of liquor can cause a hangover. A greater variety of congeners could well lead to a wider variety of effects. It can't, however, explain any beliefs about the order of these drinks, despite the age-old adage, liquor but then beer, you're in the clear, beer then liquor, you've never been sicker. Now the $64,000 question, how can you prevent hangovers? The most effective solution is also the most obvious, don't drink alcohol, or at the very least, don't drink to excess. If you're set on drinking a fair amount, though, there are certain things you can do to minimize your chance of a hangover and the severity of its symptoms, and they're all pretty intuitive. Don't drink quickly on an empty stomach. Drink slowly, either on a full stomach or while eating. Food doesn't literally absorb the alcohol, but having a full digestive tract slows down the rate at which your body absorbs the drug. Additionally, even though dehydration is only partly to blame, it still plays a role, so staying hydrated while drinking alcohol can help. Finally, try to stop drinking a couple of hours before going to bed. If your head hits the pillow after your body has already started recovering, you might avoid that problematic glutamine rebound and get a good night's sleep. It won't keep you from feeling hungover, but you'll feel a little more human than you would have otherwise. How can you cure a hangover? Is there a superfood slash drink slash ritual that can magically remove the after effects of a night spent binge drinking? Well, according to various local legends, you can cure a hangover by eating shrimp in Mexico, pickled herring, Germany, pickled plums, Japan, or drinking coffee, the U.S., strong green tea, China, or eating tripe soup, that's from Romania. A number of popular foods and beverages, like Bloody Marys, Eggs Benedict, and even Coca-Cola, were even developed specifically to cure hangovers. Unfortunately, there's no evidence that any of these homespun remedies do anything to help. There's also no evidence that the so-called hair of the dog technique, that is, drinking the morning after, has any effectiveness whatsoever. It might temporarily dull your senses, making you less aware of the hangover symptoms, but it does nothing to resolve the underlying physiological problems. And, of course, it can just lead to another hangover. Other drinkers vouch for a variety of seemingly scientific cures, vitamin B or caffeine, for instance, but studies have also failed to show that these provide any relief either. So what can you do? You can lessen some of the symptoms with well-known over-the-counter drugs. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatories such as aspirin or ibuprofen can treat headaches and other pains, while you can take stomach relief medicines, say Tums or Pepto-Bismol, to reduce nausea. You should not take acetaminophen or Tylenol, because when the liver is processing alcohol, it's especially susceptible to acetaminophen's toxic effects. You can eat food, drink water, and rest. Some research recommends eating eggs, since they contain L-cysteine, which helps break down any lingering acetaldehyde. Bananas may help by replenishing potassium lost in your dehydrated stupor, and fresh fruit juices or smoothies might give you sugar and a vitamin boost without upsetting your stomach. Drinking sports drinks to boost your electrolytes isn't a terrible idea, and pickle juice is a cheaper alternative. However, whatever you may choose to eat, at the moment, time is the only sure cure for the hangover. We'll be right back with our next segment here on Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.
KDLL Public Radio provides the news, interviews, features, and entertainment programming you trust from around the world and right here at home. Do you value local, responsible reporting or diverse music brought to you by your friends and neighbors? How about in-depth shows that are unique to your community? Then please support KDLL. We can't continue to bring you the local programming you enjoy without your support. Please visit kdll.org and click the donate button today.
Hello and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. And this month we've got a great guest, Paul Wheeler of Haynes Brewing Company. Paul, how are you doing, sir?
Hey, Bill, I'm doing really great. How are you?
Excellent, excellent. Good to hear from you. I know you're busy in the summer, so thanks for taking the time out to talk to us. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. We're brewing right at the moment.
For any of our listeners here on the Kenai who haven't had the good fortune to visit Haynes, why don't you take a minute and describe your operation?
Oh, man, the best way to describe it is just come on down and check it out. We're situated in downtown Haynes, Alaska, right on Main Street. We moved into a new building just a few years ago, 4 years ago now. And we just celebrated our 20th anniversary back in on summer solstice.
You guys opened in 99, so you've been around quite a while.
Yeah, 20 years, there it is.
Once again, I can picture the place in my head, but for the people who haven't been there, you guys have a brewery and a tap room, but it's not a restaurant, right?
Right. We have a nice little tasting room that holds about 50 people, and it's an open-air room that you are standing next to the kettle and mash tun. So it's right there. So you get to experience the action if you happen to be here on a brew day.
You've been in your new location for 4 years, but before that, for the previous 16, I guess, you guys were in a pretty tight little location over at the fairgrounds.
Yeah, that's right. We were in a little movie set building that, if anybody remembers, White Fang. That was filmed here in Haynes, the Valley of Haynes, and the movie set was moved to the fairgrounds, and it became the low-rent district for a little while until we moved into it and set up shop there back in 99. And it was pretty tight, you're right. We had the little 3.5-barrel brew system, and our tasting area was, if there was 12 people in there, that you were getting friendly.
Yeah, I remember most of the tasting was done out on the boardwalk in front of the place.
Yeah, in the summer months, you bet.
Why don't you tell people about your new system that you have that you're brewing on now?
Well, we stepped up. 3.5 barrels worked really well for 7-barrel fermenters. And so when we moved over here with a bigger floor, we moved into a 7-barrel system. and then included a couple of 14-barrel fermenters. So our production basically has doubled. At least the capacity has. Haynes has not doubled, so we're still working on growing into it.
So if you've been doing this for 20 years, how did you end up becoming a brewer in the first place?
Well, you know, we talked about it just before we started about the beer festival, and that was kind of what kick-started us. I was a home brewer back in the 80s, and we got the beer festival started in 92. So the beer festival, what the heck, that's 27 years ago that we started that, and it got pretty big. And right around the mid-90s, I was looking at the whole picture of the festival and what I was doing, and it's like, you know what, Haynes needs a brewery, so let's work on that. And so we did, and we managed to then get open by 99.
So you definitely come out of a homebrew background as opposed to being a formally trained brewer.
Oh yeah, most definitely. That's, you know, the old story when, you know, the beginning of the craft beer industry definitely was homebrewers just seeing that this can be done, and it can be done, you know, commercially. So let's look into it and do it.
So let's talk a little brewing philosophy there, Paul. Do you have any kind of overriding vision for when you brew beer and the type of beers that you brew?
Well, I guess if I would say anything, I'm kind of a traditionalist. I tend to focus on things that have been around. I like history, so I look into stories like the Captain Cook Spruce Tip story. So we have, actually, that's what we call one of our beers, is Captain Cook Spruce Tip Ale. It is fun diving into new things and checking out different recipes and whatnot, but we really try to focus, you know, on just hitting a broad spectrum and not get too crazy. Like, I'm not a fan of, you know, overhopped IPAs, for instance. And so the IPAs that we have, it finishes with the East Kent Golding hops, which is just a real pleasant, easy drinking, but yet bitter and recognizable IPA. So that's kind of where we're at with actually designing our beers.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of folks out there like you and me of a certain age that we had to really struggle to find good beer, and we cut our teeth on the traditional stuff, and that's what we always seem to go back to. We don't really love the really wild, outlandish stuff too much that some of the younger people who grew up in a world of craft beer seem to be attracted to.
Yeah, maybe we're creatures of habit.
I think so. Let's talk a little bit about your, I guess we'll call it a policy. You guys are very, very rigorous about trying to ensure the quality of the beer that leaves your door there.
Well, you're right. We, you know, it takes a lot to produce a good beer and to, you know, to hang on to that quality or the flavors or, you know, just the drinkability of it. And we have struggle with some customers that come in over our policies. For instance, we will not fill other growlers. And that's a tough one for people to grasp when they bring in their shiny stainless steel growler and we just hold on to our policy. But when we take a growler, one of ours that has come in, we take it and do the whole industrial cleaning of it. And so when it comes back and a customer is asking for one, it is a guaranteed beer-ready vessel that has absolutely no beer stone in it or any gunk. And I got some horrible stories of what has come back in a growler. It's just kind of disgusting. There are those kind of issues in our industry. And basically, how do I say it? You know, the craft beer industry has exploded and blown, like everybody knows. And a lot of the policies or standards that followed our industry might not be quite accurate or, you know, appropriate. The tastings that people ask for, they come in and ask for a flight because that's kind of a standard in our industry. And we don't do it. And we don't even give sips. And the policy there is, well, you really can't experience a beer by a sip. And, you know, you really need to go into a full glass of beer. I was reading an article by Andy Cook.
Couch, I believe.
Name was. Couch.
Andy Couch, yes.
Andy Couch, yeah. He wrote that. A couple of different beer books and beer guides. And he had an article a couple years ago that just really slams the tasting tray and the flight idea. You know, there are certain people that want to try all the beers, and so they come in and they want the flight. You know, well, that's great, but we got a lot of beer and a lot of different beers, and really legally we can't sell you all of them. You know, we have the 36-ounce rule. And he goes into that a little bit about how we've kind of forgotten how to grab a glass of beer and sitting down with a friend and enjoying that glass, talking to your friends, and that's it, enjoying a pint. You know, these flights ideas, you know, they just muddle your palate. They, you know, muddle your experience on enjoying a good beer. And as a brewer, pouring them and handing them to these travelers that, you know, they're looking for new things and, you know, and want to try everything, but they just go off on how this is bad and this is that, and it's just not that comfortable to watch. And so we don't do it. And everybody's, yeah, I'd say about 90% of the people that we pour for are okay with it. They come in and they ask if we do flights, and I might joke and say, well, we don't even own a plane. How can we do flights? So, and then they go, oh, that's fine. Can I get just a sip and try it? I was like, no, we don't do sips because you really need to experience the beer. And we have a little quote on the counter from Charles Dickinson. So he says, he's quoted in one of his novels, and it says, did you ever taste beer? I had a sip of it once, said the small servant. And here's a state of things, cried Mr. Shiveler, raising his eyes to the ceiling. She never tasted it. You can't taste beer by a sip. So that's Charles Dickens' quote. So we have that on the counter, so we can kind of just like humor a few people with that.
I totally see where you're coming from. I personally don't particularly enjoy the flights either. I very seldom would order one. And in fact, something I noticed when I lived over in Britain for 3 years is beer festivals. Over there, the festivals, I don't know if you've ever been to one, but they typically don't serve anything in less than a half pint. So none of this going around with your little sample glass and your little coupons and saying, give me a sample of this and give me a sample of that. Over there, you walk up and they're like, okay, I'd like a beer. And it's like, you want a pint or a half pint? And enjoy the social aspects of it rather than just, okay, I had that one. Give me the next one. Yeah. Give me the next one. Let me see how many of these I can tick off in the time that I have. So, well, you guys got any plans for the near future? You got any big new upcoming releases or anything else exciting that's going to go on? It's difficult, I know, because you guys don't really can or distribute your beer. So for any of our listeners who want to experience it, they're going to kind of have to go to Haynes.
We do have a couple accounts in Juneau that have been with us from almost the beginning. Really great accounts, the Hangar on the Wharf and then the Island Pub. But we live in Haynes, and like a lot of places in Alaska, we're very isolated. And so the shipping is just crippling. So we're the local brewery. And so, yes, if you really want to check us out, make a road trip. It's, you know, from the Anchorage area, it's just a short 800 miles down the Alaska Highway, and come on down.
Make sure you have your passports and you're not wanted in Canada either. As I recall, one of our brewers a couple of years ago found out the hard way when he tried to cross the border.
That's right. That's got to Beaver Creek and had to turn around. Yeah, that was unfortunate. But those are, you know, we live in the Great North, you know, so it has its challenges. And we've just sort of looked back at our original business plan, and that's basically what it says. We're going to be a local brewery providing, you know, the best product that we can locally. And call it Haynes Brewing Company.
And there's nothing wrong with that. Hey, Paul, thank you so much for taking the time to talk. I'll let you get back to your boil that I know you got going on. So
Yeah. Thanks, Bill. Well, it's nice chatting with you.
Oh, great talking to you. And like I said, for any of our listeners who find themselves passing through Haynes, you're doing a real disservice if you don't stop at the Haynes Brewing Company. So
okay. Well, one last thing is our growlers are returnable. We do buy them back.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks, Paul.
All right,
Paul.
Bill. Yep, take care.
All right, we'll be up for a break here on Drinking on the Last Frontier, and we'll be back here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.
So I wouldn't really say a boom, but maybe an uptick.
Most joints I sell come in 1 gram or half gram increments.
Outdoor recreation is a huge thing in Alaska, but how does this translate into economic development?
Every week on KDLL's Econ 91.9, we look at how businesses and individuals are responding to this challenging economic climate. Join us each Friday at 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. for KDLL's Econ 91.9.
Hello and welcome back to Drinking on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. In today's final segment, we'll be talking about the beer style known as Pilsners. Pilsner is a pale golden lager originally from the Czech Republic. It revolutionized the brewing world when it first appeared thanks to its seductive golden glow and crisp, refreshing taste. And thanks to an oversight, which meant that neither the name nor the recipe was patented, it was quickly imitated around the world. Today, for most beer drinkers, Pilsner is simply synonymous with lagers. Imitation Pilsners today account for 95% of global beer volume, although most of these beers share little of the character of the original. Like Burton-on-Trent in the UK or Munich in Germany, the town of Pilsen in Bohemia is one of those rare towns where nature just happened to leave the perfect combination of ingredients lying around, and phenomenally gifted brewers just happened to come along and find them. The Czechs refer to beer as Czech bread. They have always taken it incredibly seriously and drunk a great deal of it. But for most of beer's history, the ability to brew beers to a high and consistent standard lagged well behind the demands for quality. In the mid-19th century, the citizens of Pilsen were becoming increasingly concerned with the quality of their beer, culminating in 1838 when an entire season's brew was solemnly poured out in front of the town hall. Something had to be done, and the citizens came together to build a new state-of-the-art brewery, the Burger Brewery, which translates as Citizens Brewery, and uniting their skill and resources and stealing many ideas and resources as they could from the neighboring Bavarians. Martin Selzer was commissioned to design and build the new brewery. He traveled extensively around Bavaria and met the man he knew he wanted as brewmaster, Joseph Grohl. At the time, brown Bavarian lager was the most celebrated beer style across Europe, and Grohl was briefed to recreate a Bavarian-style lager at the new Citizens Brewery. He recruited Bavarian brewing assistants and barrel makers and brought Bavarian lager yeast with him. This lager yeast, scientific name Saccharomyces pasteurianus, was a mutated version of ale yeast that liked the cold temperatures at which bacteria could not live, one that fermented without fruity esters and sank to the bottom of the fermenter rather than floating on the top. But what came out of the tanks in October 1842 was not a Bavarian brown lager. The citizens of Pilsen were handed a golden beverage with a thick snow-white foam. The drinkers, having tried its sharp, delicious taste, welcomed it with such cheers as had never been experienced in Pilsen before. Bavarian skill had met Czech ingredients. Moravian barley is sweet, Bohemian Saaz hops have little bitterness but lots of aroma, and the very soft sandstone-filtered Pilsen water allows these flavors to come through. Soon Pilsner beer was being discussed excitedly throughout the Austro-Hungarian Empire and beyond. Perhaps as a result of their intoxicated delight, the burghers of Pilsen didn't get around to trademarking Pilsner beer until 1859, by which time there were many other beers on the market referring to themselves as Pilsner-style beers. Belatedly, in 1898, the Citizens Brewery registered the original Pilsner, Pilsner Urquell, as a trademark. The Citizens Brewery eventually changed its name to the Pilsner Urquell Brewery and still brews today. It would be incorrect to refer to Pilsner Urquell as the world's first golden beer, as the brewery often does, because color is a function of malt. English pale ale brewers had pioneered the use of pale malt decades previously, and Bavarian lager brewers freely admitted stealing the knowledge to create it from them. But Pilsner was certainly a new style of beer that had not been seen before, and its popularity spread rapidly. The birth of Pilsner Lager coincided with the greatest period of scientific innovation in the history of brewing. Railways meant beer could be transported across great distances, and information traveled even faster. Refrigeration meant lagers no longer had to be conditioned in cool caves or deep cellars. And the works of Louis Pasteur and those influenced by him led to the isolation of single-strain yeast that could guarantee product consistency. This consistency became Pilsner's byword, and the brands emerged in the late 19th century that still dominate the global beer market today. Pilsners are generally distinguished from other lager styles by their more assertive hop character. Within the style, there are two main geographic variants. Czech Pilsners, such as Pilsner or Quell, tend to be darker in color but delicate in flavor with floral, grassy aromas, while German Pilsners, such as Bitburger or Warsteiner, can be more bitter and earthy and use a variety of European noble hops as well as the beloved Czech Saaz. The Netherlands and Belgium are also home to world-famous international Pilsner brands such as Heineken or Stella Artois, and these tend to be sweeter with considerably less hop character. Pilsners created the template for the industrial golden lager that dominates the global beer market and, as such, is often misunderstood. Many so-called Pilsners have none of the character that truly defines the style, having had their maturation time cut and flavor-giving ingredients reduced to the point of extinction. Consequently, the first encounter with a true Pilsner can be a life-changing revelation to a drinker who has only previously experienced mass-produced pale imitations. I know mine was. If you were looking to experience a proper Pilsner firsthand, one of the key things to look for is freshness. As an example, canned Pilsner or Quell is often available at Fred Meyer. However, trust me when I tell you that after the rigors of traveling from the Czech Republic to Alaska, it is only a shadow of its former self. I have been fortunate enough to drink it in Prague, fresh from the brewery, and it's truly an amazing beer. However, if you can't swing a trip to the Czech Republic, I'd recommend trying some of our locally produced Pilsners instead. Midnight Sun Brewing Company cans its Wolfpack Pilsner, and Silver Gulch Brewing has bottled its Kolfput Pilsner for many years. Other breweries in Alaska produce Pilsners from time to time as well. However, for my money, the best Pilsner in the state is the Czech Pilsner produced by Zach Henry at St. Elias in Soldotna. As one of his flagship brews, it's usually on tap and exquisitely fresh. One taste and you'll understand what a Pilsner is meant to be and realize just how this beer style managed to take the world by storm a century and a half ago. Well, that's it for this month's Drinking on the Last Frontier. I hope you've enjoyed our show and we'll be back with us next month. A closing quote for this month's show, I want to leave you with some words of wisdom from the greatest of American philosophers, Homer Simpson. Bart, a woman is like a beer. They look good, they smell good, and you'd step over your own mother to get one. Cheers. What you get isn't always what you think. Beer's a